Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 22. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today's guest is Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State University. Are ritual and religion a part of human evolution? What are the benefits that religion and ritual provide humanity and society? Do other animals other than humans utilize ritualistic behavior? What part do psychedelic drugs play in human evolution? Has mankind outgrown any advantages in utilizing religion? Today's guest answers these questions and many more. Michael Winkelman earned his Ph.D. from the University of California at Irvine and his M.P.H., or Master of Public Health, from the University of Arizona. He is an associate professor in the School of Human Evolution and Social Change at Arizona State University, and he last served as president of the Anthropology of Consciousness section of the American Anthropological Association and was the founding president of its Anthropology of Religion section. Winkelman has engaged in cross-cultural and interdisciplinary research on shamanism and altered states of consciousness for the past 30 years, focusing principally on the cross-cultural patterns of shamanism and identifying the associated biological basis of shamanic universals and altered states of consciousness. His principal publications on shamanism include Shamans, Priests, and Witches, 1992, Shamanism, the Neural Ecology of Consciousness and Healing in 2000, and he has also addressed the role of psychedelic medicines in shamanism, developing neurophenomenological perspectives that link the experiences to the underlying psychological processes in his co-edited books, Sacred Plants, Consciousness and Healing, and Psychedelic Medicine. He has also addressed the relationships of healing and religious practices in his edited books, Divination and Healing, and Pilgrimages and Healing. His recent book with John Baker, Supernatural is Natural, A Biocultural Approach to Religion, addresses the evolutionary origins and biological basis of religion. I spoke to Michael via Skype, who was in Brazil at the time of our interview, and we did have some small problems with his microphone, but the quality should be okay. Upcoming interviews, Dr. Brian Ackers, who is the author of The Sacred Mushrooms of Mexico, as well as another upcoming book, and as I mentioned before, he's a fascinating guy. I've been speaking to him quite a lot over the past few weeks, and I'm really excited to have him on. Also upcoming is Dr. David Hillman, author of The Chemical Muse, and Professor Carl Ruck, author of The Hidden World, and he's, again, from Boston University. He was in podcast number one, and he has just returned from Greece and from the Ulysses and giving a speech there on that, and I'm really looking forward to having him on. Also upcoming is Dr. Dennis McKenna, who will likely be on at the end of this month or early April. Also still scheduled is Judith Ann Brown, and again, we still have not yet confirmed exactly when The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross by John Allegro will be back in print, but as soon as we have a date, she will be on the show. And we also have Professor Emeritus Marlene Dobkin de Rios, who wrote A Hallucinogenic Tea, Laced in Controversy, which is a book about ayahuasca. And also wanted to ask listeners if you or someone you know is good at doing transcriptions. I'd like to get all of these interviews transcribed, so if you can help with that, please contact me. Also, if some of you can transcribe maybe just your favorite show and send that over, that would also be a very helpful way to get these transcribed. This show is run on donations, so if you would like to support this programming, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. This show is not corporate media. It is independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by supporting this show, you help continue our programming, and without your help, we cease to be here. I know times are tough, but if you are someone who can afford to help support this show, then we greatly appreciate your help, and please do so. Thanks to everyone who has been taking me up on the damaged book offers, offer over the last 3 weeks. Once again, I really appreciate all of you who have donated either for the damaged copy of the books or just to donate. I haven't been saying people's names lately who have donated because a couple people have asked me not to mention their names because it only feeds their ego. So I guess I'm sort of applying that to everybody and just giving everyone recognition who has donated. And so again, thank you. I do still have about 4 or 5 copies of those damaged black and white second editions of Astrotheology and Shamanism available for a $10 donation or more to Gnostic Media. And that is for USA residents only. So if you send that out, I'll get you a damaged coverless copy of Astrotheology and Shamanism out to you right away. And I still have copies of the second color edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, which is numbered and signed, and that will come with a free copy of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD, which is alone is a $20 value. So you're basically getting $20 off of that offer. And I also have copies, still have copies of my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, which is also autographed if you would like a copy of that. And we really appreciate and need your support, so please go to www.gnosticmedia.com. That's G-N-O-S-T-I-C media.com. And if you'd like to contact me, you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And here is my interview with Professor Michael Winkelman. This is a really good interview, and I hope you all enjoy it as much as I did. Enjoy the show. I'm here with Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State University. And Michael, welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 22. And how are you today? I know you're down in Brazil. How is everything down there? And how's life down there?
Well, it's still a job, as it seems. I'm getting ready to do this Fulbright research on the health of the ayahuasca church members. And research is always a lot of work. And then, you know, you got to deal with the cultural differences in the language. But we're in a beautiful place. I'm staying at Wasiwaska, which is a research center run by a friend of mine, Luis Eduardo Luna. So it's a beautiful place. And maybe some of your listeners will be here someday.
Yeah, I've actually read and heard a lot about him, so that's pretty cool that you get to stay there. And so, what's that like?
Well, he's on an island. Florianópolis is an island just off the coast of Brazil, so you can actually see the mainland from the island. The island's got it's full of bays and little tiny islands, so we literally get to look out of our window across the bay, and we see the mainland, and we see the other parts of the island, and we see the little island. So it's one of those, you know, sort of resort vacation kind of spots without the the resort glitz and the people. We're at the end of a long street that's sort of translates to the Street of the Witches, so quite appropriately named in some senses.
It sounds like a beautiful location. I've never been to South America, which Ironically, my wife is from Peru, and that's something that we've been trying to get accomplished for a while now, and it just seems that either we don't have the time when we have the money, or we don't have the money when we have the time, so it just hasn't worked out yet, so hopefully that will sometime soon.
Really, I'm so for you.
So what is your educational background?
Well, I've got a formal one, and then I've got an informal one. My formal educational background was completing BA requirements in psychology and behavioral sciences and anthropology. Then I went and got a doctorate in social sciences at University of California, Irvine, where I did a dissertation on a cross-cultural study of magical religious practitioners. And then later I went and got a master's in public health and community health practices. But I think what, you know, really has kind of led me along a series of experiences toward the study of religion began as a child, you know, 5 years old, kneeling down on the hard terrazzo floors inside of the choir room beside the altar in a Catholic church. And I think that's where I learned to go into dissociative altered states. I certainly had a lot of different kinds of unusual experiences as a child with extrasensory perception. And when I got to college, I discovered the magic mushrooms. And in an important way, that sort of set me along a path of learning about these unusual experiences and the relationship to what we conceptualize as the spiritual world.
Being a professor, are you allowed to talk about your own use of mushrooms?
Well, you know, it's been one of those things that being an anthropologist, you can kind of get away with. Although I must say that, you know, it's been one of those things that at times I have felt like, you know, maybe I shouldn't say too much. But, you know, the anthropologist has the carte blanche to engage in participant observation. And so I've done so with a number of different sacred plants, beginning with the mushrooms in Mexico, in Mazatlan area where Maria Sabina is from, and continuing with a variety of ayahuasca-related experiences, particularly with the Santo Daime Church here in Brazil.
Well, that's pretty fascinating. So were the psychedelics or the mushrooms what got you into anthropology, or what drove you in that direction?
Well, I guess the psychedelic mushrooms took me into an interest in altered states of consciousness. It also rekindled my interest in psychic phenomena, telepathy, which I had experienced off and on as a child. What really, I think, took me into anthropology was the closed-mindedness of psychologists with respect to these phenomena. And the nice thing about anthropology is that it gives you the opportunity to treat these phenomena as, you know, the quaint beliefs of another culture, and we don't necessarily have to give, you know, legitimacy to other people's beliefs in order to study them. So, in a real sense, it was the feeling that anthropology was a more open discipline to studying these experiences in other cultures that led me into anthropology.
Let me ask you, you mentioned that you were mention that you were an expert witness, or?
Yeah, I was involved as an expert witness for the Santo Daime Church in Oregon. Actually goes back about 10 years or more when they first started developing their case and trying to decide how to deal with the federal government and its drug regulations that are being posed upon these churches for their use of these sacraments. But most recently, I was involved as an expert witness testifying to them in federal court in Oregon, where they were seeking an injunction against the federal government being able to seize any future shipments of the Daime. And while I don't believe that the judge has yet officially given his ruling in the case, he made it very clear in his closing comments that he was going to rule in favor of the church and that he was going to write a decision that would serve as an injunction against the federal government taking any actions against the church for the use of what's popularly known as ayahuasca.
That sounds like a pretty amazing case, and I know that more and more they've been happening recently, and I'm hoping soon that we can begin to push mushrooms that direction, because certainly they've got religious use, and not only can we prove that they have religious use with like the Mazatec and peoples of Mexico, but now we can prove that they have historical use in European and Judeo-Christian cultures as well. So that's something that that I would like to see heading that direction soon too. Go ahead.
Nice. I think in some ways the mushrooms, at least at this point, don't have the same kind of institutionalized use that has been part of the claims of the Santo Daime and the Union de Vegetal. But you're right, there's a, you know, ancient evidence of the use of, you know, the psilocybe and Stropharia species as part of spiritual practices. And so hopefully we'll see an opening of acceptance of the use of these kinds of substances as part of people's personal spiritual practices in the future.
And, you know, with that, up there in Oregon, and I had at one point tried to get you two in touch with each other, Dr. Martin Ball up there, and he's got a brand new book out, Entheogenic Evolution, where he's arguing for spiritual versus established religious freedom, and that's something else that needs to be looked at as well as a different approach, because, you know, shamanic cultures in general are not about going to some structured church. You know, there may be some instances of that, but a lot of times people are much more individualistic in their practices, and to have a quote-unquote establishment of religion, to me, seems to be a violation of freedom of religion of the individual in the first place.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen some interesting precedents in recent years where I believe both Peru and Brazil have declared ayahuasca part of cultural patrimony. And to me, it seems like we really ought to have a much broader claim about the use of the entheogens as part of, you know, humanity's patrimony of spiritual experiences. And I think that, you know, the evidence is clear that not only have these been part of human spiritual practices for at least tens of thousands of years, but there's a great likelihood that these substances may have actually played a significant role in the evolution of our uniquely human capabilities. So, in a sense, they're sort of part of our own indigenous psychology. We have sort of an innate religious capacity related to the effects of these exogenous substances upon the way our neurotransmitter systems operate, leading us into these experiences of connectedness with Gaia, with the Earth, with the universe. And so maybe one of these days we'll see the mushrooms part of humanity's spiritual patrimony and respected everywhere as that.
Well, that's, I find your statement interesting because in your recent book, Supernatural is Natural, A Biocultural Approach to Religion, you really prove, which we'll get into more later, but you really prove the evolutionary aspects of religion and through Darwinian theory. And you also talked about Gaia just a moment ago. What are your feelings about those two philosophies, Lovelock's and Darwin's, if you wouldn't mind talking about that for a minute?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Darwinian theory has a lot of different implications for understanding not only religion, but the relationship between the human species and these other plant species. And what it helps us understand in some very direct ways is how it is that human adaptations as a species have been shaped by these exogenous substances in the environment. One of the things that many people who look at evolutionary theory fail to give sufficient attention to is the recognition that one of the key influences in evolution is the influences from the environment. That's what we are adapting to. And there's, I think, clear evidence that, you know, humans and our chimpanzee cousins, if you'll accept that metaphor, that differ significantly in our ability to utilize these substances. And to me, this speaks to ancient human adaptations to the selected benefits that were accrued by the ability to use the effects of these substances to more accurately perceive our connections with the planet. And one of the things you find in shamanic cultures around the world, as well as within the contemporary traditions that use these sacred plants, is the notion that these plants connect us with the environment in some special way. They enhance our sense of the animistic properties of nature. They give us a better understanding of how the universe functions and how our own planet and the species around us function. So in this sense, I sort of see a convergence of this notion of Gaia with these ancient notions about, you know, humans' evolution. That is to say, part of our evolution was becoming more aware of our relationships to the planet. And I think these plants were a key tool in enhancing these forms of awareness.
Very fascinating. And, well, since we're on the subject, what specifically is the study of religious evolution in the context of your work?
Well, actually, my work has looked at religious evolution in a couple of different senses. My earlier work, for instance, in a book I published called Shamans, Priests, and Witches, I was concerned with how do religious institutions evolve as societies evolve. And what I focused on in that book was the idea that we were, as hunter-gatherers, universally shamanistic cultures. But that as societies became agricultural, developed more complex political systems, new forms of religious organization emerged that we would call priesthoods, and more directly tied to what we call religion. So one aspect of this has to do with just how do, you know, anatomically modern humans and their social institutions related to spirituality change as a function of the complexity of the society. But in my more recent book with John Baker, Supernatural as Natural, we've tried to push the framework back into not only our hominid ancestors, but all the way back into the vertebrae line to understand religion in a broader context. And this would be the context of seeing religion as having evolved out of ritual. And in this sense, we're trying to explain how it is that the universal features of human religion that we now find in cultures around the world emerged out of the kinds of behaviors that were used in other animal societies to organize and regulate their behavior and to communicate between members of the species. So in this sense, we would propose very roughly a series of evolutionary accomplishments that began with ritual, moved on to certain kinds of experiences, and then expanded into belief systems that allowed us to not only make sense of those experiences, but to use them in ways that allowed human societies to function more effectively.
Could you talk a little bit about some of the specifics of the cultural universals of religion?
Sure. At one level, we can say that there are a lot of features of religion that are basically found in cultures around the world. I would begin with what some have called the spirit hypothesis. I don't think you'll find any society, pre-modern or modern, in which there's not a well-established belief that there are forces and powers that, which are unseen to humans normally, nonetheless shape our day-to-day experiences. We also have, you know, beliefs in every culture that we can do something to better interact with these forces, to better understand them and their influences, and to do something to shape how they will affect us and our well-being. Other universals would include a recognition that the supernatural dimension, whatever that is, involves both positive and negative powers, benevolent and malevolent beings. And that this is an important part of understanding religiosity, bringing in the whole dimensions of witchcraft and sorcery within this broader domain of religiosity. Universal, you know, feature of religion includes this idea that we engage with the supernatural in a collective manner. Ritual is fundamentally a community kind of practice, and I'll probably elaborate later upon why I think community is such a fundamental part of religion. Alter states of consciousness. All cultures have some practices that lead people into unusual states of consciousness that enhance our ability to experience the supernatural. One of the things that cultures everywhere do is engage in practices of divination, using our interaction with the supernatural to get information that's not otherwise available to us. All cultures have spiritual and religious healing practices that are part of the way in which we deal with sickness and illness. And then we could go on to more specific kinds of things, you know, beliefs in, you know, similarity having effect through time, contagious magic, exuvial magic, lots of little specifics. But these cover some of the major areas in which we propose that there are universal features of religious behavior that are part of human nature.
In your book, Supernatural is Natural, you discuss how language mirrors reality. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think that's not a particularly surprising kind of view. I mean, we create words to reflect our experience. I think more important is to recognize that it's also the other way around, that what we perceive of reality is strongly shaped by language. That language, in a very fundamental way, creates our experience of the world. And this is embodied in the anthropological or linguistic notion of linguistic determinism. That in a very real sense, the language that we learn carries with it certain assumptions that shape the way in which we experience the world. And a major aspect of what religion does is give us a language, a set of assumptions, gives us myths and stories that create a meaningful world within which we live. And then, of course, those meaning systems have the ability to permanently shape us emotionally, psychologically, our behavior, our thought. So to me, it's not, you know, so revolutionary that we say that language, you know, in a fundamental way mirrors reality. What I think is more important in the context of religion is to, you know, reflect on the ways in which language itself produces the realities that we experience.
What is linguistic determinism? Does Hades or purgatory exist only because there are words for them?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of the views of linguistic anthropology, that language, in essence, creates reality for us. And one of the powerful ways in which the reality beyond the reach of the senses is created is through the ability of religious language to, you know, shape a worldview, a set of possibilities. So in that sense, yes, certain kinds of religious features exist only because language creates them for us.
You know, that reminds me of that old, I don't remember who said it originally, but does a tree that falls in the forest make a sound if nobody's there to hear it? And it's sort of along similar lines. If you're not creating the words to describe something, does it or does it not exist? And that's an interesting point.
I think what an important way religious language does is that it creates a language for a community, a culture, to experience the ineffable parts of reality in common, that we come to understand the meaning of nature and, you know, the things that we experience in the universe through the explanatory framework provided by religion.
And how does culture affect our understanding of other cultures and religion?
Well, in one sense, I mean, culture is, you know, a invention, just like religion can be seen as an invention, particularly in the terms of its explanatory systems. So culture can shape our experiences of the world in ways that limit our possibilities for understanding other cultures and other religions. I think that's why it's so important to take cross-cultural perspectives to understand religion, because if we don't take a cross-cultural perspective, then we are likely to be trapped within our own cultural / religious paradigms. And we won't have enough data to really understand what's intrinsic to religion, what are the universal features, what is it that we all share in common as humans with respect to these capacities for religious experience and behavior.
What are some of the effects of cultural prejudices and misunderstandings?
Well, in one sense, you know, the cultural prejudices, particularly as embodied in religion, expand on the basic principles of excluding others, of denying the legitimacy of other groups. So unfortunately, both culture and religion have this powerful potential to treat the other as Satan. And this is reflected repeatedly when we look at the interaction between religious groups around the world in the past and even today. Literally, one religion's God is another religion's devil. I mean, if you look at devil, you'll find devos, which was God, in its ancient roots. And the same thing, if you look at the roots of Satan, you'll find it linked back to what were deities in other cultural groups. So just in part reflects the power of religion and particularly religious institutions to limit our worldviews. And I think that our ability to understand what religion really is requires we move outside of any one worldview and try to see the similarities across them.
I certainly agree with that from my own work. And so many people focus on the differences of religions because they're looking from within their own, as you said, and when you begin to get outside and look at so many different religions from there and try and see it as much from each culture's own perspectives, then you begin to see so many more similarities in them than differences. But I wanted to ask you this. Isn't science really a rational study of the world and religion irrational?
Well, those are the kinds of labels we're given to try to force us to think about the world in certain ways. But, science is irrational when it's destructive. Science is irrational when it promotes ecological destruction. I think science is irrational when it builds nuclear weapons that can destroy all of humanity. Even Thomas Kuhn, I think, would tell us that ordinary science is irrational because what we know about science is that it really only makes its biggest progress when it abandons its existing paradigms and seeks new understandings of the world. So science is not always rational, nor is religion always irrational. I think that religion is perhaps best understood as a logical system in the sense that it helps us organize the way that we experience the world. We have to distinguish between what it is that religion claims, for instance, that the sun is really a chariot driving across the sky, versus, for instance, the things that religion can help us understand about the patterns of nature. And what we find in cultures around the world is that religious beliefs are intimately intertwined with the environment. Religion can provide a very effective system for deciding when to plant crops. Religion provides a variety of ways of helping humans adapt to the universe as it is. And so in this sense, it's not irrational. Its beliefs may have non-empirical aspects, but that doesn't mean that it's irrational. To the contrary, insofar as religion helps coordinate the behavior of members of a group, it's very logical to follow religious precepts. That is what allows us to get along with everybody else who shares those beliefs.
Very interesting. And I think we'll get more into that as you did in your book towards the end of this interview. I think it in the conclusion of your book, you had some pretty fascinating stuff there, which I would love to get into later. What are the primary differences and similarities between science and religion?
Well, the similarities have to do with both science and religion, depending upon our abstract cognitive capacities, our ability to create models of the world, our ability to organize our behavior within those models. I'd say in most respects, science and religion share a lot of different principles of human cognitive capabilities. The differences, I think, largely lie in terms of whether or not the system is supposed to change and whether or not the system is supposed to seek alternative explanation. Religion typically is a permanent system of belief, and it tends to adjust its explanations to maintain its pre-existing system of belief. Science, on the other hand, is supposed to change, supposed to develop a different explanation as it gathers more knowledge, and it's supposed to critically think, to question some of its basic assumptions. Unfortunately, all too often, scientists function just like religious people. They know how the world is. Don't confuse them with the facts. So ultimately, I think science and religion, you know, are contrasted in a way that doesn't do justice to the many ways in which they must and can function similarly.
In your opinion, do the layers of the brain affect religious experiences and cognition, and how would they do that?
Well, I think the different levels of the brain are involved in religious experience and cognition in different ways. Obviously, the frontal part of the brain is related to our ability to use language, to develop mythology, to conceptualize and express these beliefs. But the aspects of religious experience that I find most interesting, I think, are more directly related to the ancient aspects of our brain, particularly what's been called the paleomammalian brain, and the relationships between these ancient areas of our brain, the reptilian complex and the paleomammalian brain, I think are key to the production of what are typical religious or spiritual experiences.
Does a proper working model then of both science, or does, let me ask you, let me reword that. Does a proper working model of science and religion encompass both or separate both science and religion?
Well, I think in some ways we need different models to explain science and religion. I think science may ultimately be able to explain religion, for instance. I don't think religion will ever explain science. But in general, I think that, you know, we need to understand both of these as manifestations of humans' complex cognitive capacities. And in that sense, ultimately, yes, we need models that encompass both of these human cognitive, behavioral, emotional tendencies.
And many religions really sort of developed around creating sort of a scientific view of the world, a way to try and explain the world, which is what science is still doing. So in a way, religion is sort of science, isn't it?
Well, I think religion and science share similarities in being a cosmology. They're trying to explain what's going on. But I think science has a different set of approaches to trying to explain the world. And clearly they have to do with notions of mechanism and materialism, you know, physical causation. So I wouldn't say that religion really is a kind of science. I would rather characterize religion as a kind of cosmology, a belief system that helps organize our relationships to the world. And in that sense, it provides explanations that aren't open to question. And I think that's one of the key things that distinguish science and religion. Science, ideally, always is open to questioning prior beliefs. Religion typically is not.
How are ritual and religion a part of our evolution?
Well, the perspectives that John Baker and I have provided in Supernatural as Natural suggest that rather than seeing religion as fundamentally about belief, We should see religion as fundamentally about behavior. And so this takes us into ritual as the foundation for what becomes human religion. In this sense, then, we understand some of the broader principles of religion, such as its ability to coordinate individuals into groups and to organize societies and to link the individual's emotions to, you know, group sentiments and group functions, as being part of the ancient functions of ritual that are well manifested in the animal world. So one might think in those terms that religion is having evolved out of ritual, which is a well-established adaptive behavior in the animal world, and that in the context of the human species, religion underwent a flourishing and acquired a variety of other characteristics that we don't find associated with animal rituals.
So what does consciousness have to do with spiritual experience, if anything?
Well, I think that spiritual experiences, as we conventionally conceptualize them, are special forms of consciousness. And I have proposed that we understand these spiritual experiences as reflecting particular kinds of functions of the brain or particular forms of consciousness. As I mentioned earlier, I think it's really the coordination of this reptilian, paleomammalian brain interaction, linked together by synchronized theta waves that produce one of the signature physiological characteristics of religious and spiritual experiences.
How are altered states of consciousness important to human evolution?
Well, what I see as being one of the fundamental functional effects of altered states of consciousness is that they produce an integration and elevation of the functions of the lower parts of the brain. We have an ancient reptilian behavioral brain, an ancient mammalian emotional brain. And it's the linking together of the functions of these two ancient brain systems and their imposition on the frontal cortex, manifested in these synchronized theta waves, that I see as sort of being the signature aspects of this alteration of consciousness. In essence, what we are seeing is the integration of the unconscious and the preconscious into the consciousness. So what I see these spiritual and religious experiences as representing is an enhanced awareness of the complex cognitive processes that normally take place unconsciously.
And speaking of altered states of consciousness, you actually did some work with Professor Tom Roberts, who focuses a lot on multi-state consciousness and altered states of consciousness. Would you mind talking about your work with him briefly?
Well, let me just put my answer in a slightly different context. I think what's important to understand about what we conventionally refer to as altered states is that they're not so much a state as they are what I have characterized in my book, Shamanism, as a fundamental functional mode of consciousness. And I use mode here in the sense of a naturally occurring dynamic systemic function, just like dreaming versus deep sleep versus being awake. What we see both in physiological terms as well as in the traditions around the world is that there are these four fundamental modes in which humans function: deep sleep, dreaming, waking, and what has been called, you know, spiritual or transpersonal or meditative consciousness. And in this sense, there are a lot of different altered states within this integrative mode of consciousness. So I go back to the ideas I suggested earlier about why these altered states are important. They reflect one of the systematic functions of the brain in which information from the unconscious is being integrated into consciousness. There's lots of different states that'll do that. To me, what's most important is to recognize this fundamental biological mode of operation of the brain.
And, well, you mentioned four or five types of altered states of consciousness. What about within the altered states? There, you know, aren't there, I think even Stan Grof talks about even finding more different levels or different waking states, or not, well, yeah, I guess they are waking states of consciousness. Do we know how many types there are?
Well, I mean, you know, in one sense, there are innumerable states of consciousness because they have to do with, you know, people's beliefs and their self-reference and levels of self-awareness, etc. In my own work, I've proposed that the kinds of altered states that we find in practices around the world can be roughly understood as involving three major types. One related to the shamanic out-of-body experience or soul travel, in which one experiences some aspect of one's identity leaving the physical body and going elsewhere. Now, this would contrast, for instance, with the possession or mediumistic altered states of consciousness, in which one loses self-awareness and one's consciousness and behavior and speech is taken over by a possessing spirit that directs the individual. And then we can talk about meditative states of consciousness, in which there's a different kind of awareness about the relationship between self and the experiences that are engaged. Of course, within the meditative states of consciousness, there's lots of different forms of altered states. So while this is a rough model of the major differences, once again, I think there's perhaps an infinitude of possible altered states of consciousness. To me, that's why it's important to talk about this integrative mode of consciousness in order to understand what's similar across all these different things that we call altered states.
What other types of animals, other than human types, have or use ritualistic behavior?
Well, I'd say all of the vertebrate species use ritual. You can go all the way back to reptiles. Reptiles use rituals to interact with one another, to establish their territories, to engage in dominance and submission relationships, to mate, to reproduce. So in that sense, you know, we can begin, you know, way down on the chain of evolution and see ritual as part of the ways in which all animal species organize their behavior into collectively more functional groups.
Are there animals that show any signs of religious behavior? You know, such as humans have evolved, and I, you know, speaking of lizards and things like that, I can even think of bees that do a lot of ritualistic type behavior. But, you know, aside from ritualistic, what's the closest thing that might even border on religious behavior?
Well, one of the things that John and I have used in trying to understand the evolution of ritual behavior into religion is to look at the behaviors of chimpanzees. And chimpanzees actually have behaviors that have a lot of resemblances to what we note as being universal elements of shamanism. They engage in group displays that are dominated by the alpha males who run around bipedally and beat on the ground with sticks. They'll drum on tree trunks and tree buttresses. They'll engage in certain forms of vocalization that are very similar to the kinds of things that Grof uses in holotropic breath work. And these kinds of displays are designed to provide an auditory beacon for bringing the group together. It provides a defensive behavior against predators. And it provides a variety of other kinds of integrative mechanisms within the group. At first glance, this might not seem to be very much related to human religion, but we find that there's a lot of things about this and other chimpanzee behavior that engage what the anthropologist Anthony Wallace called the basic elements of human religiousness, ritualized behaviors of submission and dominance, things such as chanting, group vocalizations, engaging in activities that produce altered states, such as drumming and dancing and extensive vocalization, challenges to unseen beings, things like this. So we propose that we could see the roots of hominid ritual behavior and what the chimpanzees do. And we've proposed a number of reasons why we think that this complex of behaviors, rather than some kind of belief, really was the roots of human religiosity.
Okay, so back to the discussion that we sort of started at the beginning of this interview with psychedelic drugs like mushrooms. How are they important to your theory?
Well, one of the things that has been well established in recent years about the effects of the psychedelic mushrooms in particular is that they produce the full range of what are considered to be the universals of mystical experience. The sociologist Ralph Hood has looked at people's religious experiences around the world and identified a variety of core features of mysticism. And the studies that have been done in recent years, for instance by Griffiths et al., have shown that in double-blind studies, people will report pretty much the full range of classic mystical experiences as a direct consequence of the pharmacological properties of these mushrooms. So this suggests quite strongly that one of the central origins of human experiences of the supernatural came about as a byproduct, if you will, of the ingestion of psychedelic mushrooms. And we think that this is a significant feature of human evolution because laboratory studies suggest that humans have nervous systems that bond with the ergot alkaloids and psilocybin and things like this far more readily than do the nervous systems of the chimpanzees. So in essence, this indicates that part of human evolution involved an enhanced selection and reproduction among our ancestors who were better capable of utilizing these plants, and that those that did were more likely to survive and reproduce. Then we can go on to try to understand what kinds of belief systems might have been created in order to explain the experiences that were induced by these environmental features.
I've heard before that, I heard an argument once that the psychedelic use of mushrooms in traditional Mexico was used for healing rather than religion. And I thought that kind of funny because personally I've never seen the two as separate. But would you discuss more on how religion and healing are interrelated?
Well, there's a lot of different levels in which we can see the interrelatedness. One would be through linguistics, etymology. If you look at the linguistic roots of whole and holy and heal within Indo-European languages, they all go back to a common term, which is to suggest that in the beginning, how humans conceptualized this area was not three different concepts, but all one. Being whole, being healthy, being holy, being healed was all the same thing. Another level of looking at this relationship of religion and healing would be in terms of contemporary research on the effects of religiosity on health and well-being. There's more than 1,000 studies that have been done on the relationship between health and various measures of religiosity, and almost every study has found that people who are more religious, irrespective of how you conceptualize it, are going to be more healthy or recover more quickly. So these are sort of two extremes. In between, there's a lot of different processes through which we can see how it is that religion enhances our health and well-being.
What are some of those? Do we know what some of the processes are that affect religion and health? I mean, I suppose, general feeling of well-being or groupness, or what is it that religion provides? Is it sort of a placebo effect that it's giving people that makes them feel better? What exactly is in there?
Well, I'd have to start off by saying that there's lots of different things that are involved in religion. So there's lots of different mechanisms through which religion can enhance health and well-being. Perhaps one of the most fundamental has to do with a basic conceptualization of religion as fundamentally being about community. The sociologist Durkheim suggested that the roots of religion and the roots of society were the same. That in essence, religion created society by giving us a common set of beliefs. What we know about community and this bonding together in community is that it elicits the release of our own endogenous opioids, our own opiate-like neurotransmitters or endorphins. And that these in and of themselves will produce spiritual experiences and may enhance the functioning of our immune system. Another aspect of religion is a spirit belief. Spirit beliefs probably provide a number of different mechanisms to enhance health and well-being. One of the things we know about the placebo effect, for instance, is that it's not something that you can elicit in yourself, but some other person, particularly a powerful, prestigious individual, can easily elicit a placebo effect. So spirits could be mechanisms that humans invented or acquired by virtue of natural selection because of their ability to elicit these endogenous healing responses. We know that a variety of beliefs will affect our autonomic nervous system and our stress responses. And one of the things that humans do not deal well with is we don't know. We don't know what's going on. You don't know, you're worried. On the other hand, if there's an explanation that involves spiritual entities that are protecting you or looking out for your well-being, this can not only elicit the placebo effect, it can minimize stress, it can enhance our ability to cope with a variety of stressful situations. Contemporary research in psychology shows that people who believe in a higher power that will take care of them are much better off in dealing with stressful situations than people who don't. So this can be one way in which a religion enhances our health and well-being. And then, of course, these processes are all interrelated with, you know, hypnotic response and placebo effects and the ability of positive emotions, a biology of hope, to enhance the overall recuperation of our bodies. So there's not just one mechanism through which a religion can affect our health. There's a lot of different ones, and it was probably one of the major areas through which religious beliefs contributed to human well-being and human evolution by enhancing our ability to engage our own endogenous healing process.
How does our awareness of the needs of others reflect religious belief?
Well, both an awareness of the needs of others and religious beliefs involve what's been called the theory of mind, which is to say that we have the capability to put ourselves in the position of somebody else. So when we're aware of somebody else's need, we're able to basically say, if I were in their position, then I would have these needs or see things this way. And religious beliefs engage the same capacity to attribute the properties of mind, human cognitive, emotional, behavioral capabilities to the other. And it's particularly important to note that spirits are in general entities that are very much like human beings, except they don't have bodies. And so we try to figure out what is it that spirits are thinking, what is it that they want, what is it that they know. In essence, using our ability to attribute a theory of mind to other humans and infer their needs, to do the same with these unknown entities that we call spirits.
Placebo effect, hypnosis, and religious healing, how do those relate? How are they a part of human evolution?
Well, I think that John McLennan, in his book Wondrous Healing, has made a very good argument regarding why it is that the hypnotic capacity and the placebo effect really contributed to the evolution of our religious capacity and our capacity for religious healing. What this in part has to do with is the ability to engage in an imagined reality, to see things differently than the reality in which we are presently physically engaged, and to detach from that physical reality. So this can have a variety of adaptive effects, reducing stress, enabling us to imagine ourselves being in a better condition than we are, and I think in a very important way, giving ourselves permission to have someone more powerful than us exert some influence on our well-being. While McLennan doesn't make this specific point, I think that there's probably something about the dominance and submission response that elicits the placebo effect. And if we can imagine that there's something more powerful than us that can help us, then by sort of detaching our theory of mind, giving some autonomy to this spiritual other, we can then hope that they're going to do something for us. And if we believe that, then it elicits the same kind of placebo effects, the relaxation effects that go along with the submissive responses to a dominant other. When you're in your mother's arms and you feel that everything's going to be okay now, a lot of things happen. The opioids are released, stress is reduced. We have the ability to recuperate at physiological levels. And I think religion evolved out of this nexus in some very important ways, allowing these externalized spiritual others to exert an influence on our well-being by eliciting our own endogenous healing mechanisms that are reflected in the hypnotic capacity and the placebo response.
So then how does that tie in with, let me reword that. How does shamanism influence healing? I would imagine that it correlates with all of the things that you've just said there.
Well, certainly. I mean, shamans are the dominant males in their community. They're the ones that's engaged in the ritual, dancing around, just like the chimps. This is going to elicit the sense that there's a powerful other out there taking care of you, particularly when they're confronting the spirit world. But shamanism has a lot of other influences on healing processes. The altered states of consciousness that link us into our unconscious, the ability to stimulate a relaxation response in our immune system, bonding the members of the community together in ways that elicit the opioids, creating the beliefs in these spirit others that both give us a sense of protection and well-being, as well as a system of meaning. One of the things that the shamanic systems do is they, in essence, externalize the cosmology, a set of beliefs about the interconnectedness of the world that gives us a sense of understanding that promotes emotional relaxation, emotional well-being. So there's lots of different ways in which the shamanism elicits healing. This is one of the core aspects of what contributed to this co-evolution of religion and spiritual healing practices.
You talk throughout your book about how ritual, religion, and myth benefit hominoids, but how might they have a negative impact, say, like with enforcing cooperation and policing each other?
Well, I'm going to propose that in the context of our ancient hominid ancestors, there may not have been any substantial negative effects of ritual and religion in any substantial way. I would also point out that with any adaptation, it's always a balance of relative benefits over relative costs. But when we think about this in the environment of evolutionary adaptation, one of the things that these systems did was allow groups to function more effectively. I would point out that one of the fundamental effects of ritual is to reduce violence within a group. Dominant males don't have to go beat you up in order to show that they're dominant. They can raise their eyebrows and you lower your head and everything works out fine. Of course, when we get into context in which there's different kinds of ecological dynamics, then I think there may be negative impacts. For instance, if we have to cooperate with other groups, But in the context of our ancient hominid ancestors, I don't think that religion really had a negative impact. It was, much as ritual is for most animal groups, a way of coordinating the behavior of groups, reducing aggression, reducing violence, enhancing emotional well-being, enhancing the coordination and harmony of the group.
Are things like telepathy and clairvoyance real? And if they are real, what studies or evidence suggest that these phenomena are overlooked today?
Well, I would say that there's a history of 100 years or more of scientific studies of psychic phenomena. The controls that have been developed across time have been increasingly rigid. I think that there's very good evidence to suggest that these capacities are part of human nature. Of course, we've also done things to cover up and repress aspects of our human nature, so they're less likely to be experienced by people today. There was a study done some 30 or 40 years ago that suggested that most scientists didn't even want to consider the evidence for telepathy and clairvoyance. You could ask them, do you think this is real? They go, oh, there's no evidence for that. And you could ask them, well, what studies have you looked at to base your conclusions on? They go, well, there's no studies out there. Well, of course there's studies. I mean, the Journal for the American Society for Psychical Research has been published for about a century, Journal for Psychical Research about a century, the Journal of Parapsychology for 70, 80 years. Most scientists don't want to look at the data. And this is why I said earlier that sometimes science functions like religion. You already know what is supposed to be out there. So don't confuse me with the evidence. I already know what's true. And a lot of scientists are that way. They don't want to look objectively at the evidence that exists, that humans, in fact, have these unusual capacities that, while not completely understood, clearly could have played a significant role not only in the evolution of humans themselves, but contributed to the development of our religious beliefs, as McLennan suggests in terms of the effects of anomalous experiences on religious and spiritual beliefs and practices.
So are religion and science converging?
Well, I wouldn't say so much that they're converging as much it is that science is beginning to examine what is the empirical basis for religion. We might find that science and religion are starting to cover some common ground. But once again, I think that while the capacity of science to understand and explain religion is advancing, I don't think religion is going to contribute much to explaining how it is that science understands the universe. But in a number of ways, I think that there is a kind of convergence that's emerging as science begins to understand the evolutionary, rational, adaptive basis for religious beliefs and practices.
How does science differentiate between mediums who talk with spirits and telepathy, something that seems to have significant evidence to support? And what are the problems caused by such things as telepathy when trying to prove the existence of spirits?
Well, you know, you're speaking pretty directly to the problem that led from the Society for Psychical Research to the Institutes for Studying of Parapsychology. It was clear that any evidence for spirit communication couldn't be separated from some form of telepathy or clairvoyance. And people who were very interested in this in the early years of parapsychology tried to devise experiments that would allow them to distinguish between spirit communication and psi. And to the extent that they developed good studies, they were unable to show that something like the spirit communication existed apart from the possibility of psi being the real explanatory framework.
Is there a possible relationship between religion, ritual, and the treatment of OCD with psychedelics?
Well, I mean, I think that there may be a link at a couple of different levels, beginning with, you know, both ritual and OCD sharing a number of features in common that suggest that they are underlying brain mechanisms. On the other hand, we can also see a link in terms of the ability of certain rituals to enhance the functioning of the serotonin system and the ability of psychedelics to enhance the serotonin system through being basically a serotonin systematic reuptake inhibitor. So it may have been that in the past, ritual functioned as an exogenous mechanism to adjust our neurotransmitter systems, and today we're depending upon, you know, chemicals to do the same thing. So I think there's some interesting linkages there, and of course, Freud was one of the first to point those out.
How is the control of sex, in your opinion, important to both ritual and religion?
Well, if we look at the animal kingdom, beginning with reptiles and lizards, one of the fundamental functions of ritualized behavior is to allow what are otherwise separate individual entities, individuals, to interact with one another. So ritual basically allows reptiles to have sex. On the other hand, when we get to more complex animals, ritual provides ways in which we regulate the sexual impulse. As Freud and others have pointed out, the sexual drive is one of the most, you know, potentially destructive, aggressive, violent aspects of group behavior. If you look at a lot of primates, monkeys, baboons, I mean, one of the things you basically fight about is sex, and that a lot of groups end up being these sort of harems where one male controls all the females until some other male comes and kicks his butt enough to drive him off. And so you can't get big complex groups. All you got is, you know, one male controlling as many females as he can for as long as he can. And what the ritualization of sexual access does, for instance, in the activities of monogamous relationships and marriage, is basically control this very powerful drive in ways that allow larger groups to live together. So males don't have to fight over sexual access. I have my wife, you have your wife, he has his wife. And in this sense, we can see the religious sacralization of monogamy as being an important mechanism by which the potential for larger groups of humans to live together. And in this sense, we can see, you know, ritual and religion is controlling sex in different ways at different levels of the phylogenetic hierarchy, but in all cases, enhancing the ability of groups of animals to more effectively relate to one another.
What is symbolic penetration?
No, well, it's not about sex. what I'm using in the sense of symbolic penetration is the term that I adopted from Charlie Laughlin and Eugene Duaquili and John McManus's book on brain symbol and experience. What they point out is that symbols don't only affect us cognitively, they affect us at a lot of different levels. There's a good reason why there are laws that make it a crime to scream fire in a crowded bar. People hear the word fire, you know, the emotions take over and people begin to engage in panic behavior. The symbol, fire, penetrates down to a survival response. And this is what we're really concerned with in this context of a spiritual healing. How is it that symbols that represent the spiritual world, the power of spirit, the power of, you know, these particular kinds of entities to influence our well-being? And so what we have seen from, you know, the very basis of psychology is the ability of these symbols to powerfully affect our physiological responses. So a lot of phobias, a lot of psychological problems have to do with the ways in which certain symbols have become associated with certain physiological responses. What we see in the context of spiritual healing is the use of a variety of different symbolic backgrounds of the individual to elicit a certain kind of physiological response. So I'll share an example with you. I was raised as a Roman Catholic. You know, I went to church, you know, for the first, you know, first 18 years of my life on a regular basis. I'd go to church, you know, I'd have all the symbols there of the church. I'd sit down, you know, I'd listen to Latin as it was back in the 60s. I'd kind of zone out, I'd relax. You know, if I was in the choir room with my dad, I'd kneel on the terrazzo floors and I'd dissociate because my knees were killing me. And then later on, I learned how to go to church and Catholic school. And I would fantasize about all these things that were of interest to me while I was going through the rituals of the church. So I had all these associations between the church and having sort of dissociative experiences. Well, years after I left the church, I discovered in Mexico that I could go sit down in a Catholic church when I was all stressed out and be really relaxed in a very, very short amount of time. And it wasn't like I initially went there to relax. It was like, you know, where do you sit down when it's 100 degrees outside and you need a cool place to just, you know, chill for a minute? But what I had kind of, you know, come back to was this realization that all of these symbols of the church were associated with all these relaxation and dissociative responses in my past. I'd go to the church and all those symbolic associations would elicit the physiological responses of relaxation.
How are society and religion related? Actually, let me interject here. Let me just interject there that in your book on page 257, you actually state that the concept of the divine originates in society itself.
Well, here I'm once again using some of the ideas of the famous French sociologist Emile Durkheim, who saw religion as originating in society and society as being produced by religion. He saw society being produced by religion because religion gave us these common beliefs that linked us all together in a group. He also saw religion and society as being intimately interrelated in the sense that when we are members of society, we have this sense of an entity that goes on beyond us, which is to say, you know, when I die, my group is still here. And as my children go on and reproduce and have grandchildren and they have great-grandchildren, you know, in a sense, our spirit as a group exists beyond the survival of any individual. So in a sense, society gives us a kind of belief about these entities that are not dependent upon the physical survival of any one of us. And so in this sense, I see society and the spiritual as being interlinked in that society gives us this sense of, as we even say today, group spirit. And so I've looked at a lot of the anthropological and sociological argumentation about this in the book. The basic idea is that society and religion really are intertwined in some very intimate ways because they give us this sense of an entity that goes beyond the individual.
What type of societies worship the ancestors, and what type of societies worship a high god figure?
So what we find cross-culturally is that ancestor worship is linked to tribal-level societies where the structure of society and the structure of authority is based upon kinship relations, such as in a patrilineal system, a hierarchy based upon your kin and the eldest kin in the group. And in this sense, we see a religious system, ancestors rule us supernaturally, that directly reflects the actual social system. Your, you know, superiors in your kinship group are the people that rule you. So in this sense, we see kind of Durkheim's idea that beliefs about the supernatural mirror the realities of society. Research by some sociologists and more recently by some social psychologists also point out that societies that have a belief in a supreme god, a single hierarchical god over everything else, are societies that tend to have the same kind of political system, a hierarchy that basically is headed by the king or the emperor. So once again, we see a supernatural set of beliefs, one superior God over everybody, reflecting the society in which there's one ruler that's over everybody. So this sort of elaborates upon the earlier question you asked about the relationship between society and religion. What both of them tend to reflect is a power system that has the same principles. And both of them reflect a system in which there are moral rules. The rules of society, the rules of the gods basically merge in the common ancestor worship led by the leading member of the social group or the kinship group, or as was often the case in medieval Europe, where the king was viewed as a divine being and the head of the religious organization of the society. So in this sense, your question reflects basically the same kind of underlying dynamics in which societies and their implicit structures create the relationships that are then reflected or projected into the supernatural.
You're one of the few people that I've come across out there other than Professor Neil Whitehead, who I interviewed on podcast number 6, and a number of authors that he has in his book. But would you talk about dark shamanism and how it interrelates and correlates to your other findings?
Well, dark shamanism, I guess, is a term that's often used to refer to the malevolent side of the shaman, the ability to kill or cause illness. In our contemporary neo-shamanic traditions, they're often portrayed as something that's only about positiveness and healing and light. But if you look at the pre-modern world, shamans were always thought to have two sides, you know, a side in which they could heal and do good, and a side in which they could make people ill and do harm. This was basically the same process in some ways. For instance, one of the shamanic beliefs about illness is that illness can be caused by, you know, magical darts or insects or something that's sent to another person's body. And the process of healing the person is basically to remove those and send them back to the person who sent them in the first place. The process of sending them back is basically the same process of sending them in the first place. So the ability to heal was based upon the same set or capacities that were involved in the ability to cause illness or death. So I think one of the important aspects about shamanism is that, you know, it really was not just, you know, something that was all about good. What we sort of conceptualized as the witch and witchcraft, I think, had its roots in shamanism, that in the process of sociocultural evolution, these different aspects of the shamanic role became differentiated. We ended up with things like healers and mediums that are thought just to do good, and then we got the sorcerers and witches that are thought just to do bad. But originally, it was the same complex of behaviors.
You know, it's always interesting to hear these correlations because, as you said, you know, the neo-shamanism take on the healing aspects and shamanism in general are just so wrong, in my opinion. You know, I don't know if you're aware, but on my forum, I've actually got one of the few discussion forums there on dark shamanism, if not the only one on the internet. What are the negative effects of religion on society, culture, and individuals?
Well, I mean, I might start off by saying that, you know, there are so many potential negative effects today that, you know, I could never exhaust them all. I think that they might, however, be understood more basically in the sense that what the fundamental functions of ritual involve is the subordination of the individual to someone who's more powerful. And by extension, in the context of religion, what we fundamentally do is subject our individual needs to limitations placed upon us by the collectivity, as I discussed, for instance, in the relationship between religion, ritual, and sex. we basically control our own individual sexual drives in order to allow a collective group to more effectively function. So one of the underlying features of religion is that it subordinates individual interests to collective interests. There's also another level in which religion, I think, in the world today has negative effects. And when we go back and look at the origins of religion, it really was about integrating the community, integrating a group of people. And this was in a context in which humans largely lived as band-level hunters and gatherers, and in which society or community was somewhere between 25 and 150 people. So in this sense, religion was about linking together a small group of people who then were going to pursue their collective self-interest at the expenses of other groups. And so today I see this as being the biggest impediment of religion to global well-being, is that religion, you know, pits us against them. You know, it's, you know, the Islamist against, you know, the great Satan. You know, it's, you know, the Christians and their crusade against the jihadists. It creates this us-them dynamic that is not intrinsic to religion, but rather intrinsic to other aspects of human nature. But what religion allows us to do is to create bigger and bigger us's against bigger and bigger them's. And I see that as being the potentially most dangerous aspect of religion in terms of, you know, global well-being for humanity.
That is great stuff, and I hope people learn to take that message to heart, because what you just said is extremely important and something that I happen to agree with very strongly. Since religions all seem to be a part of the human evolutionary process, and since it seems that religion itself is becoming a major contention in humanity's ability to sustain itself on this global level and these massive group levels, causing more and more contention, do you think that humans will ever evolve away from such religious dogmas, or will we evolve into some new globally encompassing religion, or how does that play out? Since it's
well,
Darwin.
You know,
I was going to say it's if Darwin is right and everything is based on natural selection, and right now the religions are impeding our ability to survive, don't we have to adopt a new religion?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of species die-offs in the history of the planet, and you know, most indications are that, you know, humans will eventually suffer the same fate. Will we, you know, evolve beyond religious dogmas? I think in one sense, you know, the tendencies that lead us to accept religious dogmas are based upon so many features of human nature that I think it's always going to be part of our potential to get caught up in religious dogmas, because they give us beliefs that link us to others, that bond us in ways that make us feel more powerful than our individual selves. So I don't think we're going to evolve out of the capacity to be susceptible to religious dogma. But will we evolve some globally encompassing religion? I hold out some hope for that, although it may not be religion in the form that we currently conceptualize it. I see our greatest potential in this regard is in terms of our abilities to engage in a variety of mystical experiences that allow us to see the universal truths in religion in ways that are not tied to the particulars of a single religion. I was in part, in my own thinking, influenced by some of the ideas of Ken Wilber, who sees a spectrum of consciousness and who points to the universal truths of the mystical traditions. So I see if there's a possibility for a universal religion, it will be something that reflects the principles of Buddhism and the meditative traditions and what transpersonal psychology has engaged in terms of the psychological study of spiritual experience. Of course, what those kinds of traditions do is lead us away from religion as we conventionally understand it, and instead lead us into a kind of spirituality, which, while may take on the form of a particular religious belief system, is generally much more open to the individual differences and the individual engagement with spirituality. So if there's a hope, I think that it's reflected in the ability of the mystical traditions to help us once again understand the shamanic roots of religious and spiritual experience and reconnect us with those human potentials.
And let me point out that when you said universal religion, you weren't talking about the current one that in Latin means Catholicus. So I just wanted to point that out, that the Universal Catholic Church is not what you're talking about.
Right.
What is the main facet of your work that you would like people to take away from this interview?
Well, we need to understand that religion is part of human nature, and that many features of religion are related to our evolutionary past. Of course, not all of them are adaptations. Clearly, some of these are byproducts, and some of these are, you know, complex forms of behavior that build out of things that didn't originally have anything to do with religion per se. So in this sense, we have aspects of our religiously inspired behaviors that derive from human nature, and we're not going to get rid of them very easily. On the other hand, I think it's important to take seriously the notion that, you know, those features of our behavior that are related to our current religion didn't evolve in our current context, or as the evolutionary theorists would say, in our current environment of evolutionary adaptation. Our features of religion emerged in a context in which we lived in hunter-gatherer band society. And so one might contend that most, if not all, of the features of religion are not going to be adaptive in our current environment, that in some important ways we have perhaps outlived what was adaptive about religion in the past. And so in this sense, we have to see religion as being something that we need to adapt to in terms of our human potentials. And I'll give you a kind of example that may seem a little humorous and a little gross at the same time. One of humans' evolved capacities is called free soiling. And what it means is that humans by nature will take a crap whenever they feel like it. Now, this is not part of all primates. For instance, chimpanzees and some monkeys have an innate tendency that when they got to take a poop, they push their butts over the edge of the nest and they poop outside of their nest. So in essence, we have an acquired capacity to shit on ourselves. It doesn't take very long for human culture to overcome that. So just because something is part of our human nature doesn't mean we have to accept it. Culture has always been about overcoming the limitations of human nature. So in this sense, I don't want to take, you know, the negative aspects of current religion and their relationship to our acquired capacity to suggest that we should just accept whatever is negative about religion. We as humans have the capacity to overcome human nature. Indeed, that is probably what makes us human more than anything else. So it's sort of a two-sided coin when we look at it from evolutionary perspectives. Sure, we're led down a certain road and a certain set of tendencies by virtue of our nature, but by virtue of culture, we have the capacity to move beyond many aspects of our human nature.
Very well said. And we've been speaking with Professor Michael Winkelman from Arizona State University, who is the co-author with John R. Baker of Supernatural as Natural, A Biocultural Approach to Religion. And Michael, I must say, this has been a fantastic interview, in my opinion. I hope you enjoyed it as well. And I hope that your new book does well. It certainly captured my attention, and so has speaking to you as well. Would you like to...
Thanks a lot, Jan. I appreciate the invitation.
You're welcome. And would you like to give out any websites or contact information or anything else that you would like to talk about, other books that you have out there, etc.?
Well, sure. You can go to my website through michaelwinkleman.com. It'll redirect you, or just Google my name, and that should be one of the top hits there, W-I-N-K-E-L-M-A-N. If people want to email me, my long-term address will be Michael J, initial J, Winkleman, at gmail.com. And your readers or listeners might find interest in a couple of my other books. I wrote a book called Shamanism, The Neural Ecology of Consciousness and Healing, which I laid out the biological basis for shamanism and its persistence as a form of human spirituality. As you mentioned earlier, I had a co-edited book with Tom Roberts on psychedelic medicine that tries to explain how these ancient human remedies may have a variety of important applications in the world today. So your listeners may also find some of that work of interest to them.
Very fascinating stuff. And this concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 22. Until next time.